It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
I'm so glad you're listening to episode 274 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. This week, it's the return of Frank J. Barbieri, one of the most prolific storytellers in comics today. We talk about several of his offerings, including the most recent one, Violent Love from Image, as well as some of the others, including his time with Deja Thoris, Solar Man of the Atom, and several other comics that you should be aware of, and I would highly recommend you get them. We discuss what he's doing now and what he has in the future, as well as an in-depth look into Violent Love. So I'm sure you're going to want to hear what he has to say. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome back to the podcast Frank J. Barbieri, creator of many wonderful books and has worked at almost every company that I can think of. How are you doing today, Frank?
I'm doing well. And again, a momentous day. I don't know if you saw the announcement, but today is actually literally the anniversary of Five Ghost Number One coming out, as it came out March 20th, 2013. So we did announce that we are working on more of it. Working on number 18 right now to get out, hopefully by the end of this year. We say 2017, but we need to get a little bit ahead before we start putting it in stores. So I'm hoping for late fall, early winter.
Okay, talk to us a little bit about that. What's the next section going to be about? I mean, you know, as much as you can tell us.
Well, so we always intended to come back. It's been a question we've gotten a lot from fans, and it has been a good bit of time. I'm trying to think of when 17 came out. I think it was, I want to say July 2015, so probably almost like 2 years already. But we left on a pretty big cliffhanger, and we always intended to come back, but we just kind of got swamped with our own schedules. And to be quite honest, we worked on the book like tirelessly, publishing for 2 years straight, but also we had worked on it probably for about a year and a half before it even ever came out, and especially before it came out through Image. So we were all very, very burned out, and it was our first book that we put out in the actual like direct market with actual eyes on it. So we really need the time, but it's something we love and something we always intended to come back to. And the arc we're coming back with is volume 4. And it's certainly hopefully the beginning of a whole new continuing part of the book, as it's not like we're coming back to tell like the last story or anything like that. We are really fortunate that's a book that one, people seem to like and catch on to. As you move on and do more and more stuff, you realize not everything is like that. And as a creative person, you're proud of everything you put out, but some things people gravitate toward versus others. And Five Ghosts is definitely one of those things that people seem to really enjoy and want more of. And I've said it many times, there's definitely enough there for us that we could do the book forever. Wow. As long as people kind of keep supporting it. But with this arc, it's really, I mean, we ended with our main character's sister, who he kind of drives him on his whole quest. He's trying to find a cure for her. She's kind of comatose with her spirit kind of lost in this dream world. And the last thing that happened, the last page of volume 3, is that she gets kidnapped essentially by this cabal of villains who have been plotting against him for quite a bit, like over the whole, I guess, arc of the book, the 17 issues we've done so far. And really, we're going to see that come to a head and volume 4 and get some more details on like kind of who this cabal is. And we've hinted at it and peppered it in, but in the off time, like, we've worked enough on the universe and on some of the other details that we have such kind of like a clear understanding of exactly what our book is, like what the mythology is, etc. And I'm excited to get that stuff in. And we've had this stuff kind of in our pocket ready to go, so it's going to be a pretty seamless transition for us. I'm just excited because I feel like we're all better at our jobs now. And again, we're immensely proud of everything we've done with Five Ghosts, but it was the first book any of us did. And I speak for myself writing, for Chris Moody on art, and Lauren Affey for coloring. And we're proud of the book, but it was our first like public job. So now 4 years later, I'm excited to be, I mean, better at my job, I think everyone else as well, and really just do the best version of this book we can and continue the story we were telling.
Now, why don't you say, I think there's a subtitle, isn't it? Five Ghosts something underneath it?
It was really that when we launched the book, it was Five Ghosts, The Haunting of Fabian Gray, which was the name of the first arc. And initially, we didn't know if we were just going to do the five issues and get out or whatever. So that was why that had there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we haven't finalized the title for volume four. There's a few things I've been thinking of, but I don't want to talk about any of it yet because it is plot relevant and I want that to be a surprise. I mean, we're glad that we talk about that and now we're doing it and working on it. And certainly as we move forward, we'll be like tweeting stuff and like posting like teasers and whatnot. Because fun thing about Five Ghosts is because it takes place in a world where we kind of position that literary characters can be real. There's always fun new characters that we put in every arc, and this arc will be no exception. And I look forward to kind of teasing out who's going to kind of appear, like what new characters there's going to be. And really some of the characters we have on the villain side of it are all definitely more influenced by either famous literary figures or characters themselves. And we showed a picture of some of them on the last page of 17. And then we had the special, which also introduced Gadsby as one of our villains, which is a lot of fun. We had Fabian stealing kind of a book of names from his house and kind of finding out exactly who is involved in this cabal. So really, I'm just excited to kind of bring all that back together and keep building on it. It's been fun, and it's something we definitely missed. And of course, I love Chris's art, and I'm excited to get more of it. The teaser we posted today is literally the first Five Ghosts related thing he's drawn in like 2 years. So I'm excited to have that up.
Why don't you, for somebody who may not have seen Five Ghosts before, give us like a TV guide explanation of it.
So Five Ghosts is an action adventure set in kind of an amorphous 40s. It's not quite the actual 1940s, but we have a lot of details from there. And it's in the vein of kind of Indiana Jones and classic pulp adventures. But the hook of it being we have our main character who's possessed by five literary ghosts. So they're kind of spirits of book characters, and he can channel each of them and use their abilities. And it's Merlin, Robin Hood, Sherlock Holmes, Musashi Miyamoto, and Dracula.
Good. And a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Yeah, just exactly what I was going to say. And yeah, it was one of those just random ideas we had that we put a lot of our influences into, and really just came at it as if we can only make one comic, what would it be? And it's why we certainly feel like the book still has a lot of legs and there are a lot of stories we can tell. I mean, there was a minute where I almost did a prequel book that would take place literally before issue one of Five Ghosts, because in the mythology, like Five Ghosts number one kind of starts already a year into our main character having these powers, and we learn through flashback what happened. And I really want to do a story that takes place kind of right after he got them. So our main character, Fabian Gray, so he's still very green with the powers, not really that adept at using them. And there's some stuff I really plotted out and was ready to do, but luckily Chris came back, was like, oh, let's just continue where we left off. So we are excited because we're going to start right back at issue number 18. Like, we're not going to do any kind of renumbering or anything like that, because we've always intended the book to go on. And we know we could, like, maybe cash in by, like, doing a new number one. But we're confident, like, retailers know how to order our book at this point. We don't need to do any kind of dog and pony show gimmick. We just want to kind of get back into it and move forward as naturally as possible. And we'll definitely be talking about it a lot as time goes on. And okay. God, I can't remember what we were probably talking about 2 years ago.
Well, you had a lot of books going on from all the different companies, White Suits, I can remember, and there was a whole bunch of other ones that you were going to. I always like to talk about the fact that you don't work for one company. Depending on who decides they want to publish it, you go with them for that book, but you don't necessarily stick with one book, although you've got a couple coming out from Image now.
Image has been, I mean, people talk about them a lot as, like, quote, the best deal in comics, because they don't really take a percentage of anything. They take, like, a flat fee. And it really is more of, like, a partnership with them. Like, you don't have any editorial or anything like that. You just turn in the book and they print it and put it out. And that's that. And it is really freeing. And if you're built to do comics that way, which is very much like you're self-sufficient, so to speak, you don't need any help. It really is a great deal. And I have a few other things I'm going to bring out with them over the next, probably a year or two at this point. It's a great experience, except you need a lot of lead time at this point. And especially I've learned to keep the books on time and get ahead, because you don't really have editors poking you and coordinating. You need to do it all yourself. So I've got one project, that we've been working on for a long time now that we're finally getting ready to get together. Then one is a much newer book with an artist I'm a really big fan of. So I'm excited for that as well. But yeah, I keep busy. I'm a freelancer, so I have to take what work I can as soon as it comes up. And but I'm fortunate, as I said, to have a lot of my own stuff that I work on. But I love doing anything at Marvel and DC that crops up. I haven't really like pledged to be a Marvel or DC guy, which I see some people do, but I kind of keep my doors open with that stuff. And it's fun and exciting, but also at this point in my career, I feel like putting as much effort into my own stuff is still possibly more valid than banking on like, oh, maybe I'm just going to be the most famous like Spider-Man writer like that. But that fuels my fire. But I certainly take any of those jobs as they come.
Well, you're a good storyteller. And I like a person who can do more than one thing. In fact, the two things I'm going to focus on, revisionist and violent love, are totally different from each other. I mean, I can't imagine two more different subject matters. But a couple years ago, we talked about Black Market, which had to do with superhero blood. And then Broken World, I wrote a review of, which was like a four-issue miniseries about a world. The Earth had like was like falling apart and people were leaving. And they were leaving other people behind who weren't necessarily the best people. And then, of course, you were doing Solar, and you had the Woman of the Atom going on at that point when we talked.
Yeah, I was actually just looking at some of that Solar stuff this morning. And I was really, really proud of what we did with that book. And it was such a great experience to do a 12-issue run on it as well, to really be able to do a full – I mean, it's sad that that's rare these days, right? Like, it's – the market is just extremely competitive. Some stuff takes, some stuff doesn't. And to do 12 issues that early on of a character that iconic and unique for me was rad to put my own take on it as well. I feel like, obviously, like anything, you wish you had unlimited space, unlimited time. But with Solar, really, I was happy with what we were able to say and what we were able to do, as we did make it about Solar's daughter, Erica, who's a character I created, and really what her take on being this kind of semi-omnipotent superhero would be versus her more science-heavy dad. And that's just the thing with working with any of these licenses. I feel like that the joy in that is finding something unique to say with it, and something really at this point, much further into my career, is the joy of any of those gigs when they come up, is knowing that these characters are such platforms and finding out like, okay, well, what do I care about as an artist, as a writer, to really infuse into this without getting away from the DNA of the character. And sometimes if you can find something that you care about that really resonates with the DNA of that character, I feel like that's how we end up with some really special stuff. And I feel like one of the best examples of that recently is Tom King's Vision. Like, you have someone who, and Tom is a great writer. I've known him for so long now, and so glad to see him doing so well. But he had just such a unique take that was so personal to him that just worked so well with the DNA of the character. And things like that get me excited about doing kind of licensed work, like seeing like, oh, every now and then you can really find something specific to say, something to really push the character forward and tell a great story. So,
well, while we're talking about that, you've got another, I think, project coming up before we get to the current stuff. Howling Commandos of S.H.I.E.L.D., right? That's coming from Marvel, right?
That was actually, I think that was last year.
Oh, was it?
No worries, please. It came and went. It was it was part of the all-new Marvel Now launch, and it ended up being 6 issues. It was a book I was hoping to do much more with, quite honestly. I'm proud of what we did, but it was unfortunately cut down to 6 issues. And it was a real blast, though, because they were definitely all weird characters. I wrote it, Brent Schoonover did the art, and Nick Filardi did the colors, but we were really given a lot of leeway to do our own thing with it. And those are the kind of things where you're given like some guidelines, but then it very much becomes what you want to do. And it was a great experience, and I was proud of the book, but just with the market being so volatile, it's crazy to me to see like characters that have huge audiences just coming in and out and stuff moving around. And that's why I really feel like there's joy in continuing like Five Ghosts. The fact that we're going to now have 18 issues of that is crazy to me. Like, the fact that we went through straight with 17 before we even took a break, and technically 18 because we did the special as well, but we're really excited to have something we made have that kind of history behind it already. And again, it's not like it's thousands of issues, but it's more than enough that we've spent enough time in that world, and we really feel like we can start doing stuff that either subverts the book itself or takes it into new territory for us. I mean, once we get to 25, I'll be really, really happy. Okay. Quite honestly, like, that'll be the first big, big milestone for us, and we'll definitely find something special to do for that.
Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about, because there's a couple of other books that, before we get to the current stuff, or at least I think is current, now I'm a little uncertain that I really got them all.
Oh, no worries, please.
Because you're a hard guy to keep track of, because you put out, you basically got a library of stuff out already, all these different books.
Yeah, I'm extremely fortunate to have kept things rolling. But I've done a lot of stuff and always try to keep moving. I mean, it's part of that freelance life too, of always having to worry about what's the next thing I'm going to do after this. And sometimes you have to slow down and be let me just enjoy the project I'm working on right now.
You worked on Deja Thoris, of course.
Yeah, that was a really fun gig as well. That was, the trade just came out. So maybe it was to start in the summer and run into the fall, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's so weird to try to remember too, because as you know, the schedule of books, you work on them and then they take a few months to come out and you just never know. but no, that was a really cool gig because it was a kind of soft relaunch of kind of the Paul Perwin characters. And the idea being to make them a little more accessible for new readers and just kind of do new takes. And with Deja, it was really exciting because Gail Simone came up with the concepts for them. And with Deja's, it was that she finds out that he's adopted and her lineage is, she's not a real heir to the throne, and it kind of throws her into chaos. And there's a big conspiracy happening in Helium, and someone's trying to do a coup. And she ends up leaving Helium to track down her real identity, and through circumstances, ends up joining this Barsoomian militia. So she essentially joins the army, and it's just it was really fun to do almost an Emperor's New Clothes type story with her. And really, that was the kind of thing where I have a huge, huge appreciation and respect for the whole kind of John Carter universe and everything that Burroughs has done. But it's never something I thought about writing. And when I was giving that in, I really just looked through a lot of it and wanted to find something to say with it. And ultimately was really happy because Deja isn't a character that I wanted to completely reinvent or anything like that. I was glad we were given kind of that new in to put her in new circumstances, but I wasn't going to, again, fundamentally change her character at all. But I really used it to kind of figure out a way to show that even someone who is just and comes at ruling from the right place can still be blinded by not understanding kind of the plight of the common people or the people she was supposed to be speaking for. And that was a lot of fun to kind of put that into the book and come up with good ways to show that she's a really great leader and a strong person, but sometimes can still get lost in the minutia of the difficulty of politics and leadership. And it was a very different book for me as well. And I enjoyed doing it. And that's all out in trade now, which is cool. So both Howling Commandos and the Deja book. The Deja book is called Soldier of Memory. And Howling Commandos is called Monster Squad. And you can get those trades at bookstores, Amazon, wherever, or Comixology, wherever you like to buy books. Mm-hmm.
Now, let me touch on two more before we get to the current, what I think is the current stuff anyway. The Precinct. Talk about that book a little bit.
So that was another one that I was actually writing that book when I was writing Solar, but for some reason it got shelved for a year. I don't know if there was a licensing thing or just kind of I thought I would do better in another window. But that was another unique gig for me because it was technically part of the world that Bill Willingham established for Dynamite, the kind of legendary world, which is a steampunk take on Dynamite. But The Precinct, are one of the settings in that steampunk world that Bill created, is called the Big City, which is a quite frankly a big steampunk city in the middle of this world. And the Precinct are the police force of that city. And I was literally given complete freedom to do whatever I want just with that setup. You're writing about the police force in this steampunk city. So it felt very much almost like doing a creator own book, which was great because I got to make up my own characters, my own story, and everything that went on there. And what I ended up doing was something that I had actually thought about that I'd want to do in a creator-owned space for a while. So for me, it did feel like doing a creator-owned book, but it was a whole different set of influences because I really mined some of my love for fantasy and particularly some video game stuff like Final Fantasy. And I managed to kind of put in some stuff about the conflict between industry and magic, and that there is this establishment within the world that believes that steam isn't the answer, that alchemy and magic is the answer. And it was really fun to play with. Essentially, it's a buddy cop story where we have this kind of hard-boiled steampunk cop who just again, hates magic. And of course, the person he ends up getting partnered with is a female mage who hates kind of technology. So they kind of learn to work with each other and use each other's strengths as they have to go after this, again, crime conspiracy in a steampunk setting. So that was really fun. Again, something very different. I mean, one thing that I love is I love genre and I like doing different genres and always trying to find something in them for me to attach to or work with. And I've been very fortunate that I've gotten to bounce around a bit and really start to see from my own creative side, like what the connective tissue might be in what I care about.
Who printed The Precinct, by the way? I don't happen to know that.
It was Dynamite.
Dynamite did. Okay. Is that in trade also?
Yes, it is. Oh, good. It's a really nice collection of it. And yeah, thankfully, I feel like everything but Revisionist. I don't know what the plan is right now with Revisionist because we wrapped that actually in November or December, very recently, though. So that was one of the newer things I've done.
One other one I want to ask about, too, is one I don't – I'm always asking you about the stuff I haven't read yet. And that's another series called Blackout from Dark Horse that I haven't read yet. Talk a little bit about that is so I, you know, I know how I can access that. What's the story with Blackout?
So that was a – oh, gosh, I don't even know when that was. I feel like that was pretty early on, too. But that was part of the Dark Horse kind of superhero initiative from a few years back, the Project Black Sky stuff. And that was an exciting job because a lot of those were kind of like Golden Age heroes or old properties that they had being rebooted. But Blackout was the only new character that they came up with. Mm. So I worked really closely with my editor, Chris Warner, who is an awesome, awesome editor, a great guy, a great artist, and the person who kind of brought me into comics. He gave me my first published direct market comics work, which was White Suits Backups in Dark Horse Presents. That was basically the first non-self-published thing I did. So I'm always very thankful to Chris for that. But Blackout essentially is a character who is a normal guy who gets tied up in a conspiracy. I guess I read a lot about conspiracies. That's where I'm going with this. Where in the whole like kind of Project Black Skies conspiracy, which was the bigger kind of story frame for all these superhero stories, and gets a suit of experimental armor that lets him ostensibly open black holes that he can walk into and go to another dimension and teleport. So basically he walks through another space that is kind of like a shadow dimension of the real world and can come out on like the other side of a wall or just another side completely. And that was a lot of fun to kind of do a new superhero in the world. And there were a lot of specific things Dark Horse wanted because it didn't play into the bigger arc of their story, but it was really a great job early on and something I was a fan of. And Colin Lorimer, who did the art, did an awesome job. And an artist named Micah Kane-Shiro had done the prologue stuff, which ran in Dark Horse Presents. And that is all in the collection. Mm-hmm. And the trade is called Into the Dark.
Hmm. I'd like to see that because what I see of that, I really am interested by.
It had a great, great look to it. It was a really pretty book.
I like that. Now let's talk. You mentioned a little bit about the Revisionist from Aftershock, and I happen to like that company. I think that they're doing a lot of really creative stuff and giving people their own creative things that they can do. Basically, it seems like you just come with your concept and stuff, and they like it, they'll go ahead and run with it.
Yeah. No, it's Mike. Actually, I was very fortunate. Mike Martz, who is along with Joe Pruitt, kind of the head of editorial there and gets the books kind of secured, approached me very early on because I had started talking to him because he was at Marvel. He was the X-Men editor. And I guess my name had come up in meetings because it was right before I started doing Marvel stuff. And he had checked out some of my creator-owned stuff. And when he left to start Aftershock, I was on kind of like that short list of people to approach. So I was very fortunate to be part of kind of that first wave of creators they brought in. And we just talked, and of course I have a million things at any given time that I'm looking to do, and the thing that really resonated with him was Revisionist. And from there, they just, again, I got to work with Gary Brown, who's my good friend and an artist I've known, and actually did an issue of Five Ghosts, and I've known for years and years because he was Chris who did Five Ghosts' roommate in college, and I met them both when I lived at home in New Jersey and when I was first breaking into comics. And then Lauren Athey, who again colored all Five Ghosts, a lot of stuff I work on, so it was nice to work with a team of people I knew and familiar with, and they just kind of let us do our thing, which was fantastic. And again, Mike did edit it, and it was awesome to work with Mike because he's a great editor, but it was another thing where we were just given the space to do the work we wanted to do, and I think that it shows in the work that it's great work because it's the work that we stand behind and want to do and didn't have to compromise on.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, give us a TV guide explanation of what The Revisionist is about, if you would.
So The Revisionist is about a time-traveling assassin, and that's the short part of it. But the bigger plot explanation would be that our main character's estranged father invented time travel, and when he went and started time traveling, he quickly got drawn into a really problematic situation where time travel actually disrupts the timeline and threatens to destroy all reality. So he kind of ends up in a place where he can't return to his real timeline and has to go to recruit his son from the past to help him fix the timeline. And his son, Martin, who is our main character, is kind of a recovering criminal who regrets his kind of criminal past and is excited to kind of be involved in something good, but then finds out the way he's going to fix the past is by killing people, which is a huge compromise for him as he's a recovering criminal. So you get that tension of, okay, well, he has to do this for the greater good, as no one wants reality to fall apart, but what does that really do for his character, and what can he do to move forward to repair things with his dad and also repair the timeline? And it was a really fun book, and definitely more action sci-fi, probably more action than sci-fi, but having the time travel stuff and some of the bigger mythology about it. Like, I worked for a long time figuring out what made this time travel unique to our book, like what actually happened in the space of things. And the 6 issues that are out, I hope get collected soon, but you can get them all on Comixology or track down the issues to tell a full story. And it's kind of our main character, Martin, coming into his own and digging out some of the kind of secrets of what is actually happening with his father. Like, where is his father? It's fun because he can't talk directly to his father. He gets these one-way transmissions from him. Mm-hmm. So there's always this tension and mystery of like, oh, am I doing the right thing? Am I getting accurate information? Or am I just someone's pawn? And watching Martin go through that, he really kind of comes into his own and overcomes his past hangups. And it very much is a story about fathers and sons and kind of the weight of expectations and finding your place in a bigger sense of what you're supposed to be doing with your life, not wallowing in your mistakes, which I think thematically is something I really like to push on people, just like that you can always move forward in the present and define who you are by what you're doing rather than wallowing in previous mishaps, which is my optimist outlook, I guess.
We're going to challenge that in the next book. But do you think there'd be more if, let's say, Aftershock came back and said, we like that so much, we want to do another revisionist? Do you have more in mind for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always lucky when you stumble on something that can build into a bigger world. But definitely where we end with revisionist, while we get like a full story, there's still a lot out there that we could explore. So
cool.
It definitely is a book that I hope we get back to at some point. It's just one of those things where the comic market is so full of good stuff right now that you need to be so careful with your timing, especially with creator-owned stuff that, I mean, I do a lot of work, so I'm always careful that I'm not competing with myself, because that's the last thing I want to do. I don't want to force people who like my work to have to spend $30 on like my comics every week, let alone the other comics they might want to be reading. So,
well, they could do worse, let me tell you, because your books are very, always really creative. And like I said, you do everything from sci-fi all the way over to the next book, which we're going to talk about, which is a crime romance. But I look for your name on books because I know they're going to be really good, a well-told story, no matter what genre it is you're writing in.
Oh, well, thank you. I really hope that there are other people like you who can find that unifying thread of, it's hard because I know some writers like have such a strong brand and tend to do similar things over time. But like with me, I still, again, like to explore. I like genre. I like to do all kinds of different genres, mm-hmm. and really want that unifying thread to be that, like, oh, well, it's going to be good. Like, that's mm-hmm. all I can promise you. It mm-hmm. might not be exactly the same thing we got last time, but it will be interesting, and I'll be having fun.
Well, so. the next book we want to talk about is called Violent Love, and I was mentioning before we started recording, when I did a Google search out for Violent Love, I came up with a couple of different things. And Oingo Boingo had a song called Violent Love. And then the Urban Dictionary popped up of a definition for that is an expression used to express loving someone too much. When you violent love someone, it's as if you could hug him or her for so long that they turn purple and die, it says. And so of course, your book, there's a great little poster that came out before the one came out, and it looks like a movie poster the way it's done. And what's funny is on the inside in the middle, there's a thing that says copyright 1971. Barbieri and Santos Productions Incorporated, which, of course, the poster kind of gives that feel of that era. But then it's called An Extreme Tale of Love and Revenge. And when this couple shot, they shot deadly, it says. Talk to me about this, Barbie. Where did the concept come? Did it come from any of these things, or was it just something you thought of as you were thinking of different stories you'd like to tell?
So my collaborator and co-creator on it, Victor Santos, we met doing Black Market for Boom. My editors at Boom paired me up with Victor, which was a great pairing, and we immediately kind of struck up a friendship working on this book and consulting back and forth, speaking of Black Market. And as soon as we wrapped up, Victor was like, oh, I'd love to keep doing stuff with you and make up something new, because just the way it worked out, we kind of came to him with the concept of Black Market fully formed, and obviously he added a lot by drawing it, but it wasn't something that we really came up with together. And I knew that I'd been a huge fan of his work to begin with, so it was just like me kind of winning the lottery and being excited, like, oh my gosh, getting to work with not only someone who's great, but someone whose work I already appreciate and kind of know a little bit of the nuance of. So I simply told him, like, well, listen, like, I feel like I would love to do more of a period crime piece with you, something that was a little more kind of like pulpy and noir than Black Market, which was obviously taking some of that genre stuff and mixing it with superheroes in the present. And Victor then said to me, well, I would love to try to do something that had more of a romance angle to it. And when he said that, I kind of just went to the drawing board and started thinking, and he emailed back and forth. And he did the, I said, like, oh, well, what if we did a Bonnie and Clyde inspired story about two criminals who end up each being criminals in their own right and notorious, but then they fall in love. And he loved that and drew the teaser. And once he drew the teaser, I was like, okay, this is the project we have to do. And we developed it for a long time and really worked on it. And I did a lot of just like thinking and, okay, well, what can set this apart? Because I feel like initially, like, we weren't, I don't want to say we were cagey in our marketing, but like, we didn't really talk too much about the book, because it was definitely a book that we discovered a little more on the page once we started putting it together, because we had quite a bit of it done before it was published. We had like three issues, almost four issues done before it was in shops. And that allowed us to get the perspective of like, oh, we see where this is going in a bigger story sense. But for me, one of the main things I want to do is I want to do a frame story where we have the framing sequence in the book that is taking place in the late 80s with a young girl talking to basically this old man who we find out is a retired U.S. Marshal, and he has this wanted poster hanging up in his house of these two criminals, and the little girl asks him, who are they? And he starts telling the story. And that framing sequence, I mean, Number 5 got this week and is a very big issue, so to speak, in terms of getting some new twists and plot details. And this arc of it, like the main story that we're telling about Daisy and Rock, is 10 issues long, so the first trade will be out in May, and then we'll be back in July with issue 6 and go through 10 and then get the second paperback and then see where we're at. Because once again, we have like a world here where there's a lot of stuff we'd love to do, but this, the first like kind of real book of it, is the first 10 issues. And we found a really nice natural breaking point at issue 5. And it's actually a 40-page issue versus a 22-page issue, so there's a lot of content. But we also get, because I feel like one thing I've seen people say is like, oh, I don't get what this frame story has to do with anything, and you'll see in issue 5.
Well, you're not going to tell the whole story at the beginning. You're going to do it later on. You're going to give away piece by piece.
It's something that I laugh about a lot with some of my friends who publish comics, that it's so difficult. Like, and I don't begrudge criticism, because everyone is entitled to opinion, and frankly, sharing it is great publicity. So I don't argue if they don't love the book, whatever, get it out there. I don't care. But but these, so many things are designed as bigger stories, and you're really reviewing one small chunk of it. And I feel like specifically with my stuff, I don't try to write just kind of self-contained single issue stories. They're arcs, and to see people criticize some stuff and to know that it's going to be answered a few issues down always makes me laugh, because it's always like, well, give it a second, you'll get it, but not quite. And I mean, as I said, I don't begrudge people for posting single issue reviews, but I think Number 5 is definitely going to bring some different things into context and hopefully get people interested enough to come back for issue 6.
Well, I read Number 5. I got to read that one, and I really liked it. I've got to read them all.
Thankfully. Oh, also, did Image send out the advances, I guess? Yep. Or did I send you an advance?
Okay. Nope. I got them from Image, and I really like to be able to read them. Of course, by the time this airs, people already have the chance to get it, so hopefully
okay,
other
so
people...
Okay, so we can talk about spoilers.
Yep.
Yeah, well, obviously, the big reveal.
Before we get to that, let me read the description of the first issue, which I really like. It kind of gives a basic understanding of what the book's like. It says, Daisy Jane and Rock Bradley were two of the most notorious bank robbers in the American Southwest, and then they fell in love. and they refer to the thing as a pulp-infused criminal romance oozing with style and action. I like that oozing word. I think that's a good word.
So much of though, I credit to Victor as well, though. Like, I mean, he is such a talented artist. And, oh, and this is going back to the cover you were talking about. Like, he loves to do stuff that is, like, inspired by old, like, Grindhouse or Pulp posters. And that's why he likes to put the, like, fake copyrights on there to make it look as if it was something that could come out in 1971. And I love that stuff. And I feel like he just has such a brilliant, brilliant sense of design and is so creative and smart with not only just his, like, advertising imagery, but everything down to, like, the wanted posters he made and just all the covers he does. Like, he is just a machine when it comes to that stuff. Like, all of it, he will make tons and tons of promo images and they'll all be cool. And it's so hard to always pick one or two of these things because he'll make, like, 20 different little mock-ups and I'll be like, oh, I wish we could do them all.
Well, you know, it's interesting. His style kind of reminds me of Darwin Cook on many levels.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I actually have gotten to know Victor very well, and he's from Spain and lives in Spain and has been extremely prolific out in Spain and has crossed over a bit here, but he's just such an interesting guy. And he came to the States for the first time to sign Final Love with me, and he hung out for like a week, and I talked to him a lot about his style. And really, he cites as his primary influence, obviously Darwin Cook is in there, but Bruce Timm kind of changed the way he draws, he said, and, which I think also was an influence on Darwin. So you see this kind of everyone drawing from these same pools, but doing it a little different. And that was definitely what drew me to Victor's art style. The first time I saw it, I can't remember what, maybe in Mice Templar or something that he had done previously, but I'm like, oh my gosh, this looks like a cooler Batman, the animated series style. I mean, I love that. But it was very interesting to hear him say, like, that was his big turning point in the development of his art. And he also reads a lot of manga and has more of a European influence as well. And I think it all, like, a lot of the storytelling stuff he will do is extremely interesting. And I think he really is, like, kind of an artist's artist in terms of, like, layouts and things like that. And it's just so fascinating when I actually got a chance to hang out with him and talk to him about his influences and what he does. And he has such a work ethic. Like, he's an artist who always works on two books at least at once. Wow. He writes his own stuff as well. Like, he has an extremely prolific career in Europe as both a writer and an artist. And as I said, I just feel fortunate to get his time when I have it. And I feel like so much of comics, like any art, is finding the right collaborator for a project. And it's really that synergy between the content and style and art that makes something special. And I think with Violent Love, by design, I wanted it to be something that I thought Victor could really bring all his strengths to. And he's co-creator on the book. It's as much his as it is mine. And I really enjoy seeing that part of it as well, like that he's brought so much of himself to the project and really just made it something special. So, I mean, I'm extremely excited for our paperback because the only other person who works on the book besides me and Victor is our designer, Dylan Todd, who I met years ago and did all the design stuff for Five Ghosts and is a good friend and someone I will always work with. And he did an awesome job with the Violent Love trade design. Like, a lot of really cool little things in there. Like, on the inside front cover and inside back cover are the two, like, wanted poster images of Daisy and Rock with, like, just kind of, like, a cool, like, what's it called? Like, dot matrix screen effect over it and just little things like that. I think he makes each of the single issues look beautiful with the cover design and the interiors, but then just the trade, I think, is really a great-looking trade that I'm excited to see.
Okay, now I got to ask you, because on the back page you have a phrase that probably exemplifies the story. It says, good love is not safe.
And that, I feel like a jerk not crediting that quote in the books, but it is credited in the trade as an epigraph, and it is we're actually lyrics from a song, called Noisy Heaven by this band Beach Slang I like a lot. And I have it as an epigraph in the collection with the full quote, because actually the name of the collection is Stay Dangerous, and that's also part of the lyric. And I was just like, when we were plotting the book, I was listening to the record a lot, and that just stuck with me as such a cool phrase. And again, part of being a writer is being great at stealing, so that is where that comes from. But I feel like it is just such a nice, good, concise tagline for a crime romance book. And it speaks to, like, the larger theme that, like, you get nothing in life without risk, that you have to really be able to put it all on the line to kind of get things and get to where you want to be and take a chance in life. And I think it really just spoke to me at the right time when we were coming up with it and became one of the kind of little controlling ideas that work into every character.
Mm-hmm. You talked about Bonnie and Clyde influence and things like that, but you've moved it several decades forward, like in the 60s and through the 70s and stuff like that. Was that intentional? Did you guys want to show what these characters might have been like in a different era?
Well, we didn't want to do a direct Bonnie and Clyde story. And I feel like that's where I say we might have, I wouldn't say we flubbed our marketing, but I think a lot of people thought the book was going to be one thing, and I think are gradually discovering it's not quite that one thing, which is also a cool feeling to know, like, oh, it's not exactly what you expected. But I really wanted to get a lot of different influences in there. And the big thing for Victor was he really wanted to do like a 70s crime piece. And that was the time he wanted to reference. He wanted to use as much authentic fashion, as much kind of architecture and design and cars from that era. And that was cool with me. I was like, listen, I think that's a really evocative, cool period as well in terms of just everything going on, the backdrops, like the zeitgeist of the 70s, dare I say, is, I think, a lot more exciting, at least to me, than some of the monster. And it's nice also just do a story where, like, people aren't pulling out cell phones or using computers. Like, we see enough of that in our real life. And particularly in a story about bank robbers, like, I want it to be plausible that they can rob these banks. And I think now, just with the level of technology and law enforcement, it kind of makes it a little bit more of a planned heist to kind of execute this stuff rather than just like grabbing a gun, running into a bank and filling a bag with money and running out and getting away with it. So I think there's some romance in that kind of time frame as well. And really one of our big influences as well is I'd say the larger works of the Coens, the Coen brothers, but also particularly Fargo and the Fargo TV series, which Noah Hawley has kind of show runs and does, which is just so phenomenal in terms of catching that aesthetic and the idea of faux true crime, because we want to do a similar thing where, say, inspired by true events. I mean, in Fargo, they say the events actually took place, but they did not. And just the idea of having a story that, when you put that up front, like this faux true crime idea, knowing that, like, okay, well, there's not going to be zombies, there's not going to be superpowers or anything crazy, it kind of keeps us a little more honest in the sense of we can have crazy stuff. I mean, like, the little girl assassins are pretty nutty, but like, they're still grounded. They're not super heroic or like phantoms or anything. It's all rooted in that sense of truth, in a sense. And to create a story that has this feeling of, oh, this could have happened, also gives it a little bit of a kind of manufactured nostalgia, which is, I mean, not getting too vague or pretentious with it, but I feel like the book feels a little more unique because of that. It has this sense of time and place and events that could have actually happened. And anything that I can get in there to kind of get people to think about it or wonder, or anything that you're always just trying to elicit something from your readers, and anything you can use to help, I feel like I will gladly work in. But then the quest is to work it in as authentically as possible. And I feel like here I'm extremely happy with what we ended up with. I mean, I'm super proud of this book. I will sell it forever. Okay, in terms of having stuff at and really I'm excited to see how people react to number 5. As
it's great.
It's so hard to, well, thank you so much. I mean, you're the first human I've talked to who's read it beyond me and Victor. Okay. So I'm glad it worked for you, because I mean, when you build to like twists like that, it's always so hard because you know it's coming, and I forget people don't, and it kind of has no effect on me. But literally, we wanted to play with this idea of an unreliable narrator, and just like, there's a very succinct and I mean, I want to say it's obvious, but like, that was my big fear, like putting the first issue out and someone being like, oh, like, who dropped her off? anything like that, and just seeing through it. And literally only one person said it to me. I have a lot of people whom I've talked to, and it was a kid who worked at a comic book store. He was like, you know, it'd be cool, and then said it. I'm like, yeah, that would be cool. And so it wasn't even like that. I was just so worried, like, in the first rounds of reviews, people would see right through what you're trying to do. But I was glad they did not, and hopefully, as I said, it feels like a really nice natural breaking point for us in terms of breaking it up into two trades, that we have this hook at the end of the first volume that will hopefully get people interested in coming back for the second. And really also, it was important to me, despite talking about it as a crime romance, that we build to Daisy and Rock actually falling in love, not just have them on page one, like, wildly in love. And early on, people were like, oh, is this like Natural Born Killers? And like, God, it could not be further from that. I was like, yeah, we're not really making a mean-spirited, great. And again, I think that's an awesome film and like that, but like the film, but it's definitely not where we're going. And just marketing comics is so interesting and weird. And I just one, the less we put out there, the better. I was just like, well, you can think that probably until you read the book.
Now, let me ask you something about Daisy Jane, though, because one of the things I always like about your writing is that you have very strong female lead characters. And really, she's the one that the story rotates around. And I'm just kind of fascinated because, you know, I always rag on people who go back to a different era and make things politically correct. You know, that she's actually a politically correct woman even back in the 70s. But you don't do that.
With modern sensibilities.
Yes,
that
yes. I hate that stuff because, you know, that I would much rather see a period piece that's in the period. And Daisy Jane is a woman of that time. She understands the expectations people have of her, but she doesn't necessarily live up to them, although she plays to it sometimes, which I really liked. I thought that was terrific. I thought, man, you know, because just imagine being a woman in that era, and you realize that all these people have certain expectations of you, but you can do so much more than that.
Yeah. Well, definitely for me, it's one of those things where the character is going to make a lot of wrong decisions, and she's like very hot-headed and obviously like will not shy away from like using her sexuality as a weapon and things like that. And that can rub so many people the wrong way, but just in my like writer brain, you learn to not give a shit for lack of a better term. I'll say like, I'm going to do what's true to the story. I'm going to do what works for that and what I want to say. And one of my like writing millstones that I just like cannot speak to enough is, I feel like people are afraid to show their protagonist doing wrong. And that is such an important part of storytelling. And when audiences, idea between sympathy and empathy, like empathy being you need to understand why your character is doing stuff so you empathize and get it. But I feel like modern readers are so much more interested in sympathy and relating to the point that when they see a protagonist do something they don't agree with, they get angry. And that's not a recipe for good storytelling. You can't just make people happy all the time and give them characters they quote like. It's about seeing these people fail or mess up and learn from it, at least to me. And that's something I really want to instill in my work. And I feel like it gets a little problematic, especially with, obviously we have miles to go in terms of even just gender equality, et cetera, et cetera. But I always worry when I show even something like violence towards a female character, it can be construed as, because obviously in the real world, there's a lot of problematic analogs and things like that. But in this book, we came out early and said, like, listen, this is a gritty crime book. Like, bad things are going to happen. We're going to keep it as, again, honest and not gratuitous. Like, it all has a purpose and it all serves to something bigger. And thankfully, I feel like the audience in the book has gotten that. Both men and women, like no one has been like, I was fucking offended by your portrayal of X, Y, or Z, which again, I always worry about in the back of my head because I don't want to come off as, again, just like either just crass or like, I talk a lot about like the pornography of violence. Like there's a lot of dialogues you can get into. And I think Victor like has a very stylized approach to violence that some people liken to say even like Tarantino and things like that, where there's a lot of gore and it is crazy, but here it's not supposed to be fetishized. It's supposed to kind of remind you that it's horrific. We see so much, particularly gun violence, like we see so much gun violence in our fiction. And yeah, it becomes a little cartoonish when it's so gory, but it's also supposed to be shocking and reinvite that kind of feeling of like, oh my God, when people get shot, it's not good. It's upsetting and crazy. And I think that's what I really appreciate about Victor's take. And obviously he has a lot of Frank Miller influence as well. And I feel like you see a lot of that in Polar particularly, but I think he does such a great job of making that violence eye-catching and graphic without, it, for me at least, it skirts the line perfectly, like of being kind of appalling, but not being cartoonish in either sense. And that's the kind of stuff when you're writing that you really kind of push for, because if you write the most elegant gunfight and the artist brings the wrong tone to it, it can kind of change the whole thing. And I think so much of this book in particular relies on the acting and the tone that Victor establishes. And that's why it's such a joy to write the pages, then read them. But definitely with Daisy, I wanted to do a character who is very conflicted. And that was another one of my worries, that I feel like people read the whole arc. And something I saw someone actually say in a kind of a user review and about like, oh wow, like, so she's like really anti-crime, but then becomes a criminal. And I don't get that. And I'm like, 'cause you know, people do tend to say one thing and do the other, or like, that's not regular, but to show that she is conflicted about it, especially particularly in issue 5, where she has that dream sequence with her father saying, like, look what you've become, like, there is guilt there. And I feel like we're going to see a lot more of that in the second arc as well, showing that she becomes the thing she hates to kind of achieve what she wants. And I think that's something that happens to a lot of people, both in real life and in fiction. And to me, that's what's interesting at the meat of this story. And not only that, she effectively uses Charlie, who's not a bad guy. I mean, he cracks a bit in issue 5, but clearly under duress. And really, I wanted to show that decision she makes of, I'm not going to just escape from this life, but the first person I meet who is an out, I'm going to get my revenge. I'm going to do whatever I need to do it. And I think Victor just really, really captured that so well in those last two pages of that sequence where there's no words and she just kind of looks at Rock and Rock looks back. And then there's that big double page spread of just kind of them and their silhouettes showing the horrific stuff they've dealt with. And for me, that's really, I don't know. I think that's interesting. So I hope it carries over to our readers. And I was just very adamant about them not, it would have been very easy to have them suddenly kiss on that page, but withholding that, I feel like we'll really see in arc 2 when they actually do fall in love and what leads to that. I just didn't want it to be cheap, and not that the book is extraordinarily like true to romance genre, but I did a good bit of research into romance stuff as we were approaching this book, and I find it interesting. I'm very, very into writing craft, and it's what I like study and work towards, and always try to do better in my work. And when you're writing a romance, one of the primary antagonists is the other lover. And that's what I really want to sell in this, that it is as much of a story about Rock and Daisy at odds with each other as it is about her after revenge and after kind of all that extrinsic stuff as well. And I feel, I'm really happy with how it comes together in the second arc as well. I think people will be surprised and really get what I want to say with the book as well, which isn't necessarily the most broad and striking unique worldview, but the book really does have a very specific point, and I'm just very happy that I feel like I managed to find that early on.
Well, I have to tell you, I don't usually like love stories, and I'll tell you why. It's a 50-50 shot. They get together or they don't. And so for me, I sit there, and when I see, usually it's a love story, I'm going like, oh gosh. You know, pretty quickly I'll have a fair idea what's going on, but I have to say, obviously, these two characters fall in love, but that doesn't mean that the story's over. And I really like that about the way you do that. And I agree, the other guy that was involved, and I felt so sorry for him. You know, I felt
well, that's good. I mean, we've all been there, right?
Yeah,
like we've all wanted someone who didn't want us back. And know,
oh,
how
man, I have a habit of that. I have a habit of falling for the people who don't want me and the people. It's just the other way around. You know, either I like the one that doesn't want me, or the other one likes me and I don't want them. I can never figure it out. But it's Violent Love, it's called, and it's a terrific comic. I highly recommend it. I'm glad
Thank
to hear there's
going
to be more. When I got to the end of number 5 and I realized there was more coming, I was like, oh, good, because I like this book. Because it's a very different style.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and really, like, I feel like we had just comedy of errors with that, because the book was always intended to be an ongoing, but then when the solicit first came out, it was missolicited as a miniseries. And I feel like that's fine, but just so annoying, because I feel like because of that, some people immediately were like, oh, well, I know how this is going to end. And it's like, oh, no, we have a very natural midpoint of the story we're going to get to, et cetera. But thank you so much for the praise on it. It's really been one of those books that we've been so happy with that. Obviously we care how our work is being received and we want it to do well, but it came out better than I thought it was going to. And it's really been a great project for me and Victor. So we're glad that people seem to be enjoying
it
as well.
That's great. I love variety in my reading, and you like variety in your writing. And so it's a great, I like to read your writing for just that reason, because it's always something different. I don't know what you're going to do. And I love that in a comic.
Thank you so much. I feel like the other stuff that I have in development, you'll be surprised as well. Like, I guess there's three things coming outside of Five Ghosts that are more of that, me experimenting with new genres, new styles. And really at this point, it's me finding something about that genre that I really want to highlight or say. And I've just been really excited that particularly there's another book that I'm co-writing with my good friend. And I think it's like nothing that is really out there. And it hopefully will catch people by surprise in the right way. It's really like a love letter to different genres, and every issue kind of has a bit of a different feel and a different emphasis on genre. And I don't know, it's something that we've been working on for so long, and finally almost can talk about it. So definitely, I feel like if you enjoy the different takes on things, this one's going to be one to look out for. And hopefully we'll be talking about it around the fall.
Well, that'd be good. I look forward to that. Speaking of which, since obviously you can't talk about this stuff right at the moment, but it's good to know there's other stuff on the way. If people want to follow you and keep track of what it is you're up to, what's the best way to do that? Like social media? I know you have a website. How do you suggest we do that?
To be honest, like, I'm most active on Twitter with, like, talk about what I'm doing and always posting art and just basic, like, hype stuff like that. And my Twitter is Atlas Incognita, AtlasIncognita, which was my self-publishing imprint back when I did that. That confuses the hell out of everyone because it's hard to spell. But but that is where I tend to talk the most about what I'm working on and tweet probably every day almost. So,
well, that's your website address, isn't it, too?
Yes, it is also my website. So I at least have the uniformity there. And very good. Try to keep my website up to date, but it's a little hard. I mean, I do have a pretty detailed bibliography on my website. So if you're interested in what I've worked on, you can always check that out.
Okay. Now, as far as Five Ghosts, I want to go back to where we started. You were saying that you might not know at this point exactly when it's going to hit the stands.
Well, basically, we're finishing three issues before we put it out.
Okay.
So that it will definitely be on time.
Oh, good.
The goal we are shooting to do late fall 2017. So okay. Unless something completely tragic happens, like someone has to like take longer than they are, we hope we're going to hit that. So hopefully around November, December.
Oh, good. Well, I'm already looking forward to that and other stuff that you've gotten. I can't wait to hear about the other stuff you've got, the irons in the fire already, because I love a good story and I love something I haven't seen before. And I've been reading comics for a long time, and you're one of the guys that gives it to me on a pretty consistent basis, which I like.
So, thank you so much. And please always feel free to check in with me via email. So
okay.
The last thing I will just plug real quick that I totally forgot is coming soon is I did a really fun, unique project for DC. I did with my friend Steve Orlando. We co-wrote the Martian Manhunter, Marvin the Martian crossover that's coming out in June. And that was an absolute blast. And I think we'll really surprise people because it's much more in line with DC tonality than Looney Tunes tonality.
Oh, really?
So it was really a blast to get to do both those characters and treat Marvin a little more. He's still funny, but in a serious way. And obviously coming up with the natural connective tissue between him and John, the Martian Manhunter, was a lot of fun. And Aaron Lopresti is just doing such fantastic art for it. And his take on Marvin, though, is so, so good and so expressive, even though Marvin has no face. But the stuff he's just doing with his eyes is so great. So I cannot wait for people to see that. And that'll be in June.
Oh, boy.
The solicits just came out, I think. So.
Yeah, that'll be excellent. Can't wait. Frank, as always, you're doing wonderful stuff, so please keep it up. I know you will. And hopefully it won't be 2 years again before we get a chance to talk. Great stuff.
Yeah, thank you so much. Like I said, I can't believe it's already been so long, but very appreciated.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
That's it for this week, but be sure to be back next time for episode 275 and a special interview. But until then, keep reading your comics.
It's over, Joker.
Over? Why, my dear delusional Dark Knight, it hasn't even begun.